Greetings from BBS Radio. The truth and news still exist in the original form. You're tuned in to The Spiritual Politician, the show that shows you where politics, government, and selfishness went wrong, and how you can take action to make it right. I'm Melinda Pillsbury Foster, your host for this hour of insight, aimed at making each of us more responsible, more cooperative with each other, and more aware of the spiritual bonds that connect us, no matter what we find to bicker about in the interim. You can call us toll-free from the United States to 877-876-5227. You can call from Canada to 888-810-8322. Or you can call us direct to 530-876-3222. This show is carried online, and you may be also able to get it on the air in your local area. To find out if one of those old-fashioned on-the-air stations in your area carries this show, you can just contact us at bbsradio.com. The website for this show can be found on the BBS Radio site and at spiritualpolitician.blogspot.com. All past shows become available as soon as it is humanly or unhumanly possible on the station archives. Now, my own blog is How the Neocons Stole Freedom. Blogging is one of the ways that we can ensure that the truth is not absolutely squashed flat and ground up as a byproduct of the fascist corporate state. I think, therefore, I blog. It is good for my soul. This week, my blog is titled, No Question is Out of Line for Dick Cheney. Civility is for the soul. You might guess that I was annoyed with Wolf Blitzer for failing to carry through on a nice start. If you persist in treating criminals like they are due respect, you know, you can't really be surprised that criminals like Dick Cheney think that they deserve civil behavior. Americans should accord respect only to those whose actions affirm accomplishment by means that extend the cultural capital of cooperation through doing the right thing. No robber baron deserves our respect. No PR agents for robber barons do either. You can decide which category Cheney belongs in, or you can put him in all the categories. His ego is big enough to justify that. And now some comments on the events we're following that are still in motion. Last week, we talked about the imminent ratification of the ERA in Arkansas. Since then, another full speed ahead drive has been reported in Arizona. Thanks, Arizona. Pretty soon, it will be a race to see what Neolithic Neanderthal-type state will prove its unfitness to be part of the 21st century by not having ratified. Despite all of the propaganda you hear on the subject, the intention of the Equal Rights Amendment is simply to do what should have been done in 1787. Ensure that both men and women were affirmed in their inherent God-given rights. This is how the Equal Rights Amendment reads. Equality of rights under the law shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of sex. Now, you know, I didn't see anything in there about unisex bathrooms, about going to war, or about anything else. And, of course, one of the issues that it brings up is why in the world should government be passing laws about what we do with our personal lives anyway? It makes you wonder, doesn't it? Not surprisingly, those who have been lied to about the ERA and what it means have been reacting as if it was proposed that we cut off some essential part of their anatomy. Ouch. One gentleman contacted me insisting that women had not earned rights. He said that women had not fought in the revolution. I asked him if he was a descendant of any individual who had fought or participated in that war. He was not. Like most Americans, his family came through Ellis Island at a much later date. Why, I asked him, did he think that those who poured life, blood, and resources into that war were doing so to capitalize him and the other males while not providing the same benefits for their own daughters? He was making a collectivist argument, obviously, by lumping together males as the inheritors of what the revolution had produced. Well, I told him, all of our ancestors fought in and capitalized that war, all lines of my family. It actually looks like they hardly had a skirmish without one of mine being there. Those same people went on immediately in the wake of that war to work for abolition and suffrage. So, you know, I think he's wrong. In the minds of many who fought, the idea of rights for women and blacks were very present. He's the free rider. I then invited him to get off the train. Haven't heard from him again. I'm waiting for the arguments about the restrooms and how women will have to go into combat. In case I did not mention this before, the Schlafly clones, who are now infesting the Arkansas Capitol, are using the same literature they were passing out in the 70s. Evidently, they have failed to notice the world changed. Women are going into combat, still without their rights. They miss a lot, and in their cases, that might just be for the best, for the Schlafly clones. And now our thought for the week ahead. As the Bush administration prepares to surge over the cliff into a chasm deeper than any past president has contemplated, the Bush atrocities here at home are beginning to evoke reaction. The presence of a Bush Library and Policy Center threatened for Southern Methodist University has resulted in a movement in protest that has generated an online petition approaching 10,000 signatures in 2 weeks. The parallel petition in support sports less than 100, many anonymous and with similar wording, curiously enough. Methodists are angry, and talking about the outrage of having anything associated with the Bush presidency located on or near the campus. Mr. Andrew Weaver, a Methodist minister and psychologist who graduated from SMU, wrote the wording for the petition and is among the group of clergy who are demanding that the library go elsewhere. It has been suggested, not by the clergy but by myself, that the appropriate location be near a federal facility that should be the Bush residence after the impeachment. Dr. Weaver is with us this evening, I hope. Because
I am.
Oh, you are. You're there. Thank you.
I'm
well,
leave.
Dr. Weaver's here with us this evening to talk about the moral content of the Bush presidency. And that's certainly a subject that is going to offend many Americans. Dr. Weaver is, as I said, a Methodist minister, a graduate of SMU, and also a psychologist who's written a book on post-traumatic shock syndrome, something that I think many Americans are in need of today. Please welcome Dr. Andrew Weaver.
I'm pleased to be with you, Melinda. Thank you.
I am so glad to hear your voice. I cannot tell you.
Well, I've spent most of my adult life, 15 years of it, in Northern California, so it's coming back home from being very cold here in New York today.
Yes, definitely. And I'll try to send some warm air to you through the telephone.
Appreciate it.
Now, we always start by asking our guests to tell us something about themselves. So tell us a little bit about Andrew Weaver.
sure. I am a United Methodist pastor. It's a church of 11 million in this country. Tends to be on the progressive, moderate side with elements that would are concerned, so it's very much middle America. I'm also licensed as a clinical psychologist, and I've written and worked as a clinician 6 years in a state facility for the severely mentally ill, where I became an advocate for what is happening. It's a group of people that are probably the most harshly treated of any group in our society.
Mm-hmm.
I was a pastor in San Francisco at a church called the Church for the Fellowship of All Peoples, which was founded in San Francisco as the first intentionally interracial congregation in America, 1944. A remarkable church founded by a man named Howard Thurman, who was a when Dr. Martin Luther King was in the Birmingham jail, he had two books with him, the Bible and a book by this man, Howard Thurman, called Jesus and the Disinherited. So I've been a very blessed person, Melinda, because I was raised in the American South, born in 1947 in Raleigh, North Carolina, where at that time, North Carolina was more like South Africa, really, than it was any image of the Republic. And so my own spiritual transformation, and to a great extent, is dealing with what I learned as a child, which were racist attitudes. So I'm very deeply passionate about my religion because it has been a liberation for me through Martin Luther King and through the women's movement. The place, interestingly enough, that I really became aware and became a feminist was in seminary, in a Methodist seminary, the one at Southern Methodist University, that now I have so much concern about that university being overwhelmed and consumed by a gigantic think tank, which Doonesbury called in a cartoon recently a belief tank.
Yes.
I'm pleased to be with you and talk a bit about what we're protesting.
Amen. And I have
Amen.
A message for you from Bishop Joseph C. Sprague. He asked me to say hello and tell you not to be so shy about talking.
Okay.
He and I had a very nice talk this afternoon about some other things related, because I wanted to be well prepared for this.
Good.
Now, you said something about your own background coming out of the South, and of course, there are a lot of different related issues here that go to sort of the cultural content of the way we live and the kind of life message that, you know, we create with the actions of our own lives and that content. So, thinking about it that way, and thinking about Bush and the kind of message that he sent to Americans with the content of his own life, I know that Bishop Sprague had some interesting comments about President Bush during the period of time when he was governor and then now that he is president.
Right.
Do you have any reactions to the Bush governorship and the Bush presidency in terms of your own faith?
Well, I think it's generally the intention is for all elected officials, and particularly the President of the United States, that you certainly want the best, because this is a person with such enormous powers over our lives in the world. So when he called himself a compassionate conservative, it was something that I think it was a way of trying to frame what you would see as the Methodist Church and the Presbyterians and several others, kind of moderate America. But it turned out that this president has been anything but moderate on everything.
Mm-hmm.
And that his extremist positions, which we find out are highly related to a group called neoconservatives, who really do have a sense that they want to use their power to dominate the world.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
They see themselves at the, they talk about perhaps the United States only has another couple of decades in which they have the kind of power to do this, and they're going to take what they can while they can. Well, this is about as far from fundamental Christian beliefs and the teachings of Jesus Christ as you can go.
It would be hard to get further, wouldn't it?
Pretty much. St. Augustine in the 3rd century, who was a great intellectual who really was able to combine the ideas of the Roman Empire and the emerging Christian world, was asked once, and to remember he was an African intellectual, this man, what are the three great Christian virtues, Linda? And his answer was humility, humility, humility.
I don't see much of that in Bush, somehow.
Well, we can be given all the power in the world, but to be counter to the reign of God in the world is to be anything but humble. And what you have in this president, and I'm sad to say that Dick Cheney also claims membership in the United Methodist Church, you have people who are, they're hubris, and their narcissistic self-interest is so intense that they have what the old classic problem is in the old language Christians would call sin, and that is to say that they really want to be God.
Mm-hmm.
And they act like, now we're told by the president, no matter what the people feel, that he's the decider. He comes darn close to saying he's the dictator. And I think this is why you've got the Congress now really reacting in the Republican Party, because those people who instinctively know that the Republic itself is in danger when a president acts like a divine right monarch.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's exactly what he's doing. And certainly in the case of SMU, he has, for a long time, we have found out, been sort of manipulating events so that he could have what he wanted, which is an institution with his name on it on that campus. They very covertly managed to take condos and completely eradicate a little community of elderly people who had thought that was going to be their home.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that hasn't necessarily been talked about of very much.
Mm-hmm.
And then the issues that have been raised because of what he's doing that you've gone into with the torture, the preemptive
mm-hmm.
war, and the other issues that, you know, that his presidency raises certainly don't make this look like an institution that belongs associated with any church. But certainly I think that what I've gotten is that the Methodists especially find this abhorrent.
Well, the Methodist tradition, it was a spiritual movement that began in the 1700s in England. And John Wesley, who was an Anglican and Church of England priest and an Oxford Don, was a remarkable figure in terms of just being a person of great heart and intellect. And when the Methodists came to this country, about the time of the American Revolution, there were only a few hundred. But they were, in terms of socioeconomic things, more like Pentecostals are now. They were the underclass, poor, striving people with a very intense sense of justice, because John Wesley had been the primary figure, Melinda, against slavery in the British Empire at the end of the 1700s.
Mm-hmm.
There were 166 slave ships that came out of the three southern ports of England, that's Bristol, London, and Liverpool, in the 1770s. That money generated by the slave trade was much of the money that propelled the British Empire to be an empire. And it was the equivalent for John Wesley to confront slavery, not as just a moral issue, but an issue of enormous power. It'd be like taking on Enron and all the other large oil companies. So when John Wesley, with great courage, and he was stoned at times and riots against him, where rich people would pay people to come and try to mob him, but this kind of passion for what's right, not just that Methodists were good at organizing the better, Sunday schools. It has to do with justice and passion. This is always at the heart of any positive religious movement. In this country, then, when the Methodists came here, they were very involved in abolition. The church split in the 1830s and 40s over the ownership of a few southern bishops with slaves. And the Methodist church said, we would rather not be together. We just will not condone it. Now, I believe personally, and many of my colleagues do, that the use of torture by this president is the moral equivalent of slavery, that it is so barbarian and undercuts every system of law and civility that it simply can't be tolerated. And that's the firmest stance that I and your 14 bishops in the United Methodist Church, we now have more than 600 clergy in the United Methodist Church and almost 9,000 members from churches, about 80% are Methodists. So this is the passionate appeal here is towards standing for something.
Mm-hmm.
And if we as Christians and people of faith and conscience, no matter whether we're religious believers or not, can't stand against slavery, we've got to ask ourselves, what in the world would we stand for?
If you can't stand against slavery, if you can't stand against torture, if you can't stand against the inherent deceit of this administration, then what do you stand for?
Well, it is. And so I believe that this question of the library and this massive think tank, which the New York Daily News, a very famous reporter, DeFrank, wrote a piece about this think tank being his useful purpose being to polish his legacy. And Lord knows he's going to need to polish it. But the purpose here is not, and this is why the faculty at Southern Methodist University is so upset. If there was a vote, it'll be extremely interesting to see how the faculty come down, because what they're proposing, Melinda, is $500 million. Now, that is half of the endowment of Southern Methodist University. To get an idea of the size of this.
That's huge.
On the campus, and neither Southern Methodist University or the United Methodist Church that owns that university and founded and built it would have any say over it.
That's very unusual. I don't know another instance where that's the case.
We don't either. We think it would be a precedent, and that's why there was a piece by Dr. Samuel in the New York Times a few days ago, and I'm sure that made the point that even with the library, the executive order, the first executive order that George Bush signed as president in 2001, was to make sure his father's papers and those related to Iran-Contra come to mind would not be seen ever, as it turns out, because not only can George Bush's dad say, I don't want to see it, but his descendants can do that.
That's
so
ridiculous.
You can imagine if George Washington had said, I don't want anybody to see it, and all of his descendants agree with it, we wouldn't know to this day. So it's an absurdity to call it a library. What it is a propaganda outlet that will only have those things that are not shredded and those things that are not hidden I can't say that word, forever and ever, a world without end.
Yes, I do that too. Looking at this, it's so much an absolute parallel to everything that they've done in their administration.
Absolutely.
It's all about control. It's all about greed. There isn't anything there about the people. There isn't anything there about what you see. You don't even see, you know, a nuance of what America or Christianity really is supposed to be about. But they've taken on the coloration. They use the words.
I do believe that President Bush and the right-wing religious people, and I'm talking here about James Dodson of Focus on the Family and Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson, I believe these people have done more fundamental damage to the witness of the Christian religion than anybody in the modern world. And the reason for that is the level of their capacity for propaganda and the power they have, but the distortion of what they've done. These people, and this is why I think that this petition, which is Linda on www.protectsmu.org, why this petition is so important, because it's the ordinary, decent, humble, patient, church-going person in small towns across America that are signing this.
Yes,
and
absolutely.
And writing these incredibly passionate things about how they have felt betrayed by this man who has betrayed their beliefs and the Jesus they follow.
Yes.
And that is a remark. I must say that is the that touched me deeply because, you know, I know many of the little small towns in Texas across the South. Half of the United Methodist churches, and we have 28,000 in the United States, half of those churches, Melinda, are in small rural communities with less than 200 members.
Mm-hmm.
So you're talking about America at the ground level, if you read that narrative. And it's an epistle to the modern church and to the world we live in, a compelling cry for justice.
Mm-hmm.
And the pastor at Highland Park United Methodist Church, which is the church adjacent to Southern Methodist, the president is a member of that church, and his pastor, Mark Craig, is on the trustees and has said that we're just a fringe group to be ignored, and he was a trustee and he wouldn't pay any attention to us. And this is precisely, of course, the attitude that the president has toward the American people now.
Well, that's exactly what they say. They simply dismiss it. If you don't agree with them, it doesn't matter. When I went and looked at both petitions over and mm-hmm. over and over on the petition that supports the library, they tried to characterize the people who were opposed as socialists, mm-hmm. leftists, simply, you know, that one of them, I think, used the term of, you know, frothy-mouthed liberals.
Mm-hmm.
You wouldn't have thought that you were looking at a set of people who were committed Methodists. About almost, if you take a look at the other site, by the way, when this show started, there were 98 signatures on the support, the library.
And that's the one that says protect SMU from all the kooks and left-wing weirdos?
That's right. And then on your petition, there were 9,965 signatures.
Yep.
And I looked at every page, and most of them identified themselves by a church affiliation, and many, many of them were Methodists, and many of them were pastors or ministers.
Well, about 80% of the people in there are identify as the United Methodist Church, but we also have got, and I would encourage anybody of conscience, ask them to identify themselves, because ultimately we would give the whole, everybody who is in there, except those that we can take out pretty easily, the ones that are mean-spirited and bogus. I have purposely actually left in many of the mean-spirited ones because I have a background in psychopathology and forensic psychopathology. And I must admit, I find it clinically interesting to read them. And I think I'm going to write a paper on this sort of responses because psychologically, one of the things, and I know you're an expert in the neoconservative movement and very much appreciate that, what you've done. But, you know, you may remember William Crystal. I think it's the guy, the Weekly Standard, his father, he said in the Wall Street Journal way back at the beginning as one of the patriarchs of this neocon movement, you don't attack argument, you attack the person, you attack the integrity. And this style of ad hominem argument is really what's used there. What's extraordinary, and I must say I find somewhat amusing, is that since they don't have arguments they can make that are strong, many of them simply are emotional rants. This is the saddest thing, perhaps, of all the things this president has done. You know, Franklin Roosevelt said the only thing, Melinda, that we have to fear is fear itself. Jesus was very powerful about fear not, because fear, manipulated and used, will turn people into suspicious, distrustful, angry, vengeful, and then ultimately hateful. And that spiritual journey is the opposite of the journey of love, of compassion, the journey of tolerance, the journey of that turns the heart towards gratitude, towards generosity, and towards an openness to life. And mm-hmm. those two, every president has a bully pulpit, and this man has preached so much fear, and he has created so much hatred. That is the worst of all the legacies.
Well, that is his legacy, though.
Well, it, at this point, unless he has a powerful conversion of the heart, I fear it will be to the end.
Well, people tend to be what they are, and you can't change it. The only person who can change you is you.
Well, I think that there is an adage, Melinda, in psychology, I'm sure you know it, that the greatest predictor of future behavior, or the best predictor of future behavior, is past behavior. And the psychodynamics have been, there's psychologists and psychiatrists here in New York who have done a brilliant job of analyzing some of this. And one of the things that runs through it, of course, is that this president, and tragically for him and us, was, by his own confession, someone who was drinking heavily from the age 15 to about 40. And what we know about addiction is it tends to be a way of escaping the normal maturity process.
Mm-hmm.
So one of my concerns about the reactions and other people who are observant in mental health field is some of what we see as rigidity and is partly a reflection of just someone who doesn't have the kind of abilities to be flexible. But I do think that the people are speaking. I feel hopeful that now the Congress and people like Hagel, God bless him, you know, he has voted with George Bush so consistently, and now he has had a transformation and change of heart. And the ferocity with which he is condemning this war has to be admired.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So I do in some ways, you know, I feel more positive, Melinda, than I did a couple of years ago. When I felt as though the people hadn't quite awakened. You know, the American people are slow to awake and to be aroused, but once they are, they can be a powerful force. And this petition, to me, you know, is a way in which the Methodist people who, you know, the bishops in the United Methodist Church have been trying to have an audience. It was like, go to the White House and speak with a man who's a member of their own church, who laid his hand on and took vows that he would be committed to this church. These are the consecrated elected heads of this 11 million member church. He has deigned to speak to them and has shunned them. And they have passionately appealed, even before the war, Melinda, that this was wrong. Now he wishes to go to the largest of our schools that has the name Methodist on it, and it would, you know, it is for those of us who, for generations, have a love this church and what it's done for good. I mean, there are 123 educational institutions related to the United Methodist Church. It has been. No institution in the history of the Republic has done more good than the Methodist Church, and we simply say that it is not tolerable that a president who's given authority to torture human beings, who has in a war of aggression against the people in Iraq that breached every treaty in the Geneva treaties that were formed after the Second World War, is totally unacceptable that he be associated with our name.
It's amazing. When you look at it, it is completely mind-boggling. You brought something up a few minutes ago about the neocons and about Pat Robertson, and I don't know if you mentioned Ralph Reed. But people think of them.
I know who he is.
But people think of them as religious figures, but actually what they did had nothing to do with religion. They were members of a young Republican group, and in the group was also Jack Abramoff.
Mm-hmm.
And what they and Karl Rove, and they decided that what they were going to do is they were going to create a reliable voting bloc for themselves by going into Christian churches and politicizing them,
mm-hmm.
which
mm-hmm.
is one of the places that the present sort of evangelical movement came from, the political,
mm-hmm.
you know, idea part of it.
Right.
And I think slowly as it sort of sunk into to people that that's really what's going on there, there's been a kind of a reaction and a horror. And in evangelical churches, even now, I mean, on the issue of the environment, I think you have more than 80, and that number is rising, of churches who are simply moving away
mm-hmm.
from the agenda that sort of brought that whole movement into existence.
Yes.
So in many ways, I do think this is a time for renewal.
Well, I would say what I've always felt is that, you know, if you read the words of the Gospels and the words of wisdom that are in the Jewish writings and the Greek writings in the Christian Bible, that these are deepest wisdoms that we have from our ancestors trying to understand and interpret our meaning and purpose and place in this world, in this universe. And those ethics talk about blessed are the least among us. If you care for the least, and this comes from the Jewish prophetic tradition out of which Jesus was, if you have the ethics of compassion and care read every week, I think that there are many good evangelical conservative Christians whose hearts are ready to look honestly at what has happened.
Mm-hmm.
I think this book by this young man who was working in the White House in the faith-based programs, I can't remember his name at the moment, a man who wrote about what he saw, there are many people speaking up, I think, and I think those of us who come from the liberal tradition need to appreciate that religion is such a powerful force in this country. Still, about 60% of Americans once a month attend some place of worship in the United States. And I think one of the things that we must do as liberals is appreciate this fact and understand that those who still overwhelmingly, most of middle American Christianity in the Protestant traditions and in the Catholic traditions are decent, good, hearty people that mean well. The people who have been passionate and organized are still a minority, but they've been very passionate about what they believe. And religion, of course, is about passion. It's about the biggest of all questions. You know, how can we be in a universe of 400 billion galaxies and understand what exactly it is for you and I to have consciousness?
Mm-hmm.
These are the most passionate and interesting questions they are. But passions also can be manipulated. And I think the cynicism that you're pointing to from people like Mr. Reed and others, that part of this, I have been pleasantly surprised, and I shouldn't have been surprised, at the perceptiveness of people's comments about what has been going on. The narrative, religious narrative in this country has been held almost exclusively through the media to right-wing religious groups that skew the debate. I mean, mainline Protestants and most of Catholics have virtually no voice or very little voice on the general media.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that a petition like this does is give people in these religious communities like the Methodist Church a voice and say, and it is an extraordinary thing if you think about it, this is a kind of shunning or rebuking of this man and what he's done.
Yes.
Because we're saying we don't want to be associated. That is a very powerful thing. The United Methodists are not going to excommunicate this president, but I do think that rebuking him is very consistent. I don't think so. I know so. With fundamental ways that Christians deal with people who are destructive in their community.
Well, you have to, because if you let somebody continue to do what is inappropriate, you're not you're not being with them the way you need to be with any other human being. People need to know when they've crossed barriers.
Well,
like with a child. And this is a man who was never raised to adulthood.
Right.
So how is he going to know, given what his family is?
That's a good point. Thomas Merton had a great influence. I don't know if you've run across him, but he was a great Catholic thinker and a monk, a remarkable man who was an expert in Buddhism.
Mm-hmm.
And Merton, he did say something that's very powerful. He said the ultimate judgment about our souls, we cannot know of another person, because truth is, Melinda, if you and I had been born to Barbara and George Bush in those circumstances, we don't know if we would have turned out that way. But what we have to do is make judgments about the temporal behavior of this man. And Judgment Day is not just something that comes at the end of his life. Judgment Day is now. And this is about judgment. This is about saying this behavior, there is now absolute evidence, and that there's a professor, Melinda, at the University of Minnesota, a full professor in medicine, and he's now a colleague and friend through communicating in the last several weeks, and he wrote a book called Oath Betrayed. I think it was published last year. And in there, what he documents is that we have tortured to death 19 people that have been in the custody of the American military, and hundreds and hundreds and probably thousands of people have been tortured another colleague and friend of mine is a man named Craig Murray, who was the ambassador to Uzbekistan and protested at the Home Office in the United Kingdom. He, I'm proud to say, grew up a very devout Methodist.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know where he got his conscience to do it, but he just told the Home Office, we're talking about the State Department, you know, I get on my desk stacks, literally. He told me this personally, of confessions that are identical. You know, my son and my father went off to Afghanistan. Well, people will sign anything, Melinda. You know, you tell people you're going to pull out their toenails, and in this case in Uzbekistan, dip their children in boiling oil. Now, you tell people that, they'll tell you anything. And so he went to the embassy in Uzbekistan. He sent his second-in-command, he said, over there and tell them, this is absolute rubbish. It's useless. It's nonsense. And the ambassador, the embassy in Uzbekistan told him, we use this, the CIA uses it, and it is of value to us. What these countries like Uzbekistan have done, and Syria and Egypt, they are doing this because it pleases the Americans. And we are guilty, at torture on the industrial level. So when these people at SMU, the president of SMU, President Turner, has repeatedly said in public, well, you know, when the president's gone, it'll just be history, and it won't be politics anymore, it'll be the past. Well, he's wrong.
Yeah,
because
that's
what's going to happen, Melinda, is these stories of horrors that have been done with our tax dollars in our name, under the authority of this man as the president of the United States, are going to come out for decades. And he will be a man who will be acquitted in history with General Pinochet. It is like Notre Dame said, well, we'll welcome a $500 million institute on Notre Dame's campus, over which we'll have no say, nor the Catholic Church will have any say, dedicated to the honor of General Pinochet. That is what this is.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
You can see I don't feel passionately about it.
No, I can see that this is a very, you know, that this is, you're indifferent to this subject. But how could anybody be, right?
You know, Melinda, I mean, my grandfather, my great-grandfather, and my great-great-grandfather were born in the same county in eastern North Carolina as I was. In 1811, my great-great-great-grandfather, your ancestors come from deep roots. I'm sure the people listening here. And, you know, it's a disgrace, you know, to the memory of my ancestors who worked as just dirt farmers and just humble, good, law-abiding citizens. Frankly, Melinda, I would prefer death over thinking that people are using torture and international kidnapping to keep me alive. I think that is a life, frankly, based upon some I do not want to be a part of. And I intend to try to live by higher standards.
Amen.
So the call, apologize, go ahead.
Well, I think that's, there's so many Americans, I think, that are coming to the conclusion, and but one of the things I think that keeps some Americans from acting is the simple, the shock, the disbelief that this could be happening in the name
right.
of the country that they love. It's something that it's hard for them to accept.
That's a great point. I think it's absolutely true. I remember coming, this book was one of the parts of it, because I think you're absolutely right, because what you've got to come to is the depth of the problem. And it really does, in many ways, shake the foundations of your fundamental belief. And that, you know, we want to believe that the things done in this country, in our name, that we are decent and good people, and we are. We've been betrayed.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a hard emotional thing to come to. Because I'm, like any other American, you want to believe that the people, at least if you don't agree with them, I mean, on politics, you know, we have differences of opinion, but that's not what we have here. What we have is, are people that have committed crimes in our name, and they're continuing to do it. I mean, now they're still holding. I saw a case today. There's a man who has been held, who knows how many, without, I mean, people in Guantanamo being held for years, not seeing their families, not having a day in court, testimony now based upon torture. I mean, these are things that are medieval.
Well, they are, and I think one of the things that's happening here is that eventually we're going to look back and understand about George Bush as a human being. Is that this is very much a reflection of what is in him. Because when you take a look at his history as a person and the amount of energy that this administration spent trying to clean up his record and excise things about him using an enormous amount of capital so that he would be, you know, at least acceptable as a candidate, that what we're going to see eventually is that this is a man who enjoys torture.
Well, let me say this, that it's to understand that we also reelected him. I mean, irrespective of whatever the process was, there were millions of people voted for him. We also have to take consequence for our action. It is a little, if you give me a little bit deference as a psychologist, it is a little easy for all of us, and I do it myself, I'm first in line, to project onto him. We all carry around the potential to do bad things, and we do that. And I think it's important that I have a lot of anger towards him personally, but it's a much larger issue about the spirit of this country and about our own ethics. And we have done, and the church is first in line. I mean, I'm embarrassed by what the church hasn't done. I mean, what in the world are we in 6 years? And we haven't stood up before this in the way we should have. So,
well, this must be very cathartic for you, then.
There's a whole lot of emotions.
Yeah.
You know, I feel that's a very good shrink response. You made me reflect internally there, Melinda. Of course, it is. What is it? Gosh, there's, you know, the ability to have a voice, because I do feel the great responsibility to my ancestors. My father-in-law was a war hero in the Second World War. He's a two-star general. He was, I come, like you, from, you know, remarkable people, and he flew 113 missions across Nazi Germany in a plane, and I think to myself, I've never one day of my life had as much courage that he had to do that. And I'll tell you, I can die more easily if I stood up to try to fight, because I don't want to disgrace the memory. I know that my father-in-law in a million years would never put up with this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and there are a lot of military people. I tell you, the number of generals that have come out, it's unheard of.
It's amazing. It's never happened before. Could you please give people the location again for the petition? Because one of the things I noticed when I went and looked at it, and some of it made me cry, was, and we talked about catharsis, this is giving people something that they can do.
Right. Yes, exactly. And I want to say it will make a difference, because if we can get the kind of power and influence, you know, the United Methodist Bishops and the church itself owns this property. And even if the trustees, who are close, wealthy friends to the president, who dominate that board, the United Methodist Church has the ability to veto it. So it's not as though you are chasing windmills. I mean, this can make a real difference. The site is, Melinda, www.protectsmu.org. And you can go on there. It costs nothing. Put your comments and understand that you know that you can make a difference doing this. And we want all people of conscience, whether or not you're involved in religious community or not, to just tell us who you are, so in the end we can be able to know who has signed. And we believe this is a real accountability for the President of the United States, who has really not conducted himself, as I say, torture and war of choice are not not Methodist values.
Amen. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Well, I thank you for your hospitality, and I peace be with you, and I thank you.
You take care. God bless.
Thank you, ma'am. Bye-bye.
Bye. And that's our show for today, Friday, February 2nd, 2007. On this show, as we do with all our shows, we end by reading the section of the Declaration of Independence that is America's mission statement. Take it to heart. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed, that when any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it, and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. Prudence indeed will dictate that governments long established should not be changed for light and transient causes, and accordingly all experience has shown that mankind are more disposed to suffer while evils are sufferable than to right themselves by abolishing the forms to which they are accustomed. But when a long train of abuses and usurpations, pursuing invariably the same object, evidences a design to reduce them under absolute despotism, it is their right, it is their duty, to throw off such government and to provide new guards for their future security. This is Melinda Pillsbury Foster, coming to you from BBS Radio. God bless the journey that brings us to freedom, and may God be with you every step of the way. Good night.